Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode, I am joined by Jessica Marie with her very first public interview that she's ever given. So congratulations to Jessica, and hoping to launch a new pathway for her of giving interviews and talking about her experiences and her work publicly. And it's a pleasure to have her here on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast to kick that all off. We had a great conversation just a couple weeks ago. She shared aspects of her own healing story of dealing with fibromyalgia, her work with Tom Lane, and participating in Mesoamerican mushroom rituals, which, by the way, Tom Lane's going to be coming back on the podcast and sharing more about that soon. He was on a few years ago. That episode has now moved to the Entheogenic Evolution archive over at my Patreon page, but we're going to have more Tom Lane here. So Jessica shares a little bit about that and also her own entheogenic church, the One World Heart Church, which you can find at oneworldheart.love online. But first, a few announcements before we get there. I'd like to extend a hearty thanks to Petra, Eric, and Rick, all of whom signed up as new patrons over at my Patreon page. And they all signed up at different levels, which is reflective of the fact that there's different levels for everyone, from everywhere from $1 a month all the way up to $100 a month that gets you a 1-hour consultation call every month with me, and increasing access and benefits and bonuses and things like that. Joining up over at Patreon is a great way to support this podcast. It's a great way to support me while I'm making art and music and writing books and recording audiobooks and doing all those things that I do that then put out into the world for people to enjoy and inspire them. So if you feel so inspired, please stop by my Patreon page at patreon.com/martinwball. Find the tier that's right for you. And of course, there's no obligation. You can sign up for any amount of time that you want. You can quit anytime you need to, or your financial situation changes, or your interest in supporting me wanes if that happens. So there's no obligation over there. Of course, I also do accept PayPal donations in support of the podcast. You can stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net. Use the PayPal link at the top right of the page. I don't have any PayPal contributors to support, or excuse me, to thank for their support for this week. But, you know, who knows? Maybe next week. Coming up on the podcast, just let you know what is in the works here. I have an interview that's ready to go from Ikaro Connect, which is a new psychedelic services advertising company working out of Austin, Texas. We had a great interview the other week talking about sort of the whole change that's happening in the psychedelic world with entheogenic churches, legal psychedelic therapy, and marketing and promotion needs of such organizations. It's an interesting conversation, kind of a sign of the times sort of conversation. Looking forward to bringing that to you. Also have a great interview with Rachel Harris, who is rejoining the podcast. She was originally on in like 2018 talking about her book, Listening to Ayahuasca. And we had a great conversation about her newest book, Swimming in the Sacred. So that's also coming up here on the podcast. So lots more great stuff to come, as usual. But let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Jessica Marie. Just to remind you one more time, her website is oneworldheart.love, and that's for her entheogenic church, which she will be talking more about here in our interview. Of course, I'm going to put in one of my new songs from my latest album, The Fate of Marani, the soundtrack, after the conversation. So just stay tuned for a little bit of music to move you on to the next stage of your day. All right. Be with you again next week as we get into the next chapter of my medical memoir, A Sleep Story. But for now, here's Jessica Marie. Okay, well, I want to welcome on to the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. My guest for today is Jessica Marie, and I'm just going to give a quick bio and then going to let her jump in. But she is the founder of an entheogenic church, the One World Heart Church. She also has gone through a personal healing journey of dealing with fibromyalgia, a little difficulty saying that one. And also recently, she's taken up the study of Mesoamerican mushroom ceremony with Tom Lane. And we're going to talk about all of these things in the podcast today. So Jessica, thank you very much for being a guest on the show, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Martin. It's such an honor and pleasure to be here.
So is this perhaps the first interview that you've given on a podcast, or have you done others before?
This is my first one. You caught me.
Awesome. Well, I always love doing that, you know, that on the podcast, you know, I've been doing this for over 15 years now, and I really take great pleasure in having both established people in the field and also getting people for their very first interview. And I've always enjoyed seeing how people have been able to kind of launch into a more public sphere after being on the podcast, and also formerly when I was organizing talks and events here locally, the same thing would happen where I'd bring in brand new people to give a talk for the first time, and then suddenly they're speaking at conferences around the world and stuff. So I love that, and always happy to you know, provide an opportunity for people to introduce themselves. So
deep breaths.
There's no pressure. No pressure.
Stay in your heart.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So Jessica, you and I actually met relatively briefly at the Entheogenesis event in Texas, and we didn't really get a chance to connect and talk there. And that's kind of what spurred the idea of, well, let's get to know each other, but come on the podcast and we'll do it for the public. So this is kind of serving two purposes: allow us to kind of get to know each other a little bit more and introduce my audience to you and the things that you're doing. So let's just start with you and kind of get your story, and maybe we might need a little bit of an explanation for fibromyalgia as well, and then how that spurred your own work into psychedelic medicines. And so we could start anywhere you would like with that.
Okay. Please. Well, I would like to start by saying I am the mother of an absolutely beautiful, incredible, sweet, intelligent little girl named Jasmine, who will be 7 next week. She is my inspiration and my why for everything that I do. And without her, I don't know where I would be. And so I just want to start by saying that. I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia over 10 years ago now. And what happened was I was a very successful young woman. I had a bachelor's, and I had done pharmaceutical sales. And then I had actually begun my own long-term care consulting company. And I was doing very well, and I was helping the elderly find long-term care and living situations when they couldn't return home. And I went to the gym for maybe 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. I was really fit, took good care of myself, had, you know, endless energy. And then one day I just felt really under the weather, and it never got better. It just progressively got worse. I started getting, I had a lot of back pain and like knee pain over the course of my life. But I just chalked that up to just growing pains or, you know, being alive really. But it ended up spreading everywhere, and it was really inexplicable, and it was combined with extremely chronic fatigue, forgetfulness. I was extremely sensitive to cold and heat, noise. And it was just, I thought I was dying, and so I started going to all these different doctors and getting all these different tests run to see what could possibly be wrong. You know, I got tested for Lyme. I went and saw somebody from the CDC at one point because I had a random bout of pancreatitis that put me into the hospital for almost a month, and I wondered if I was going to die there. You know, so my body was just having all these autoimmune responses, and finally, they chalked it up to fibromyalgia, which is a condition of the nervous system, which is chronic pain. There is no cure. They're not quite sure what causes it, although they are beginning to look at the nerves in the blood vessels, and there being like some type of different composition. And of course, our blood vessels go, you know, all over our body. And so I had followed all of the guidance and advice from all of the doctors and specialists. You know, I took all the medications that they had prescribed, and I just kept progressively getting worse. I mean, it didn't matter diet, movement, swimming, reading, meditation, breathing, nutrition, supplements. I had a whole shelf in my fridge dedicated to supplements. And I just kept progressively getting worse. And I was married and I had stopped trying to have children because I was so ill. And then, of course, I got pregnant and I was like, well, I'm going to have to figure this out. And so I actually had some of the symptoms alleviate for a little while, because when you're pregnant, it can cause the body to, the stem cell production can really help exacerbate or reverse some of those symptoms. But shortly after I stopped breastfeeding, the symptoms, you know, all kind of came crashing back down onto me. And I had gone through some pretty difficult things with my now ex-husband, and it was definitely in everyone's best interest for us to get a divorce. So now I was going to be a single mom, and I had to find out how in the heck I was going to honor my little girl's life. And it came to me like a miracle. I came across an article online about ayahuasca and how they believe that it created neurogenesis and neuroplasticity in the brain. And I had a light bulb go off and I was like, the nervous system is comprised as the same tissue as the brain, which is why it's the nervous system. And I was like, if I drink enough of this brew, I can regrow my nervous system and cure my illness. So a week later, I was on a plane down to Florida and I went to SoulQuest. Everybody knows about SoulQuest. And I love SoulQuest. I am so grateful for everything that they did for me. But I started going down to SoulQuest almost monthly, and I was drinking ayahuasca, and then I would also volunteer and help out with their ceremonies. And I started also utilizing Combo, the little frog from the Amazon, as well as psilocybin at home. And then I was invited to sit with Bufo, 5-MeO-DMT, our lovely divine toad friend. And that one, I mean, they all made a monumental difference. And every time I sat with any sacrament, really profound healing would occur, because I would feel all this really stuck, painful energy in my nerves and in my nervous system clearing out. And many of my journeys were extremely, excruciatingly painful, exhausting. And it was a lot, but I got progressively better each time. And, you know, I was called to work with the medicine, and I ended up meeting, my first mentor, and I just started working with the medicine. And I mean, it just is, and here we are. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing all that, Jessica. And I'm going to ask you a few follow-up questions about some of the stuff you just shared. But first, I just wanted to start with a little heart-to-heart and just say congratulations on making it to where you are now. And that bond that you have with your daughter is just very evident by what you've shared here. And I just want to comment that I think it's very beautiful that, you know, I'm the father of three kids, two of them are older and they don't live with me. They live quite far away, so we don't see each other too much. But my youngest, Jaden, he just turned 10, and he's like, I mean, I can't even express what he means to me and that bond that we have and what we share. And so I can really understand when you say that, you know, she's your world. And happy birthday to her. By the time this comes out, she will have turned 7. And I believe you just had a birthday as well, correct?
Yeah, I did.
And I just wanted to just share a little sympathy with the whole thought of going through a divorce, having a small child, and having a chronic condition. These are all things I've dealt with myself. Where, you know, I have this chronic sleep condition. Some days are better than others, and then there's other days where it just literally kicks my ass. It just kicks my fucking ass, and it's really hard to deal with. So I know what it's like to see doctor after doctor and try thing after thing, and just the frustration, the feelings of hopelessness, and where to turn for help, and then having relationship issues come up at the same time, you know, that during some of the worst parts of my sleep disorder, my wife and I were separated for a time. And it was all really hard. And it's hard to go through in these, you know, kind of these life events. It's not easy being a human being and, you know, finding our ability to trust and to love and to still live with light in our life sometimes can be a challenge through all of this darkness. And I'm just very happy to hear that you found a path to some relief and some release from the difficulty of the fibromyalgia. And I've known some other people who have had it, and it's very, very difficult to deal with. So I'm just curious if you might share a little bit more around the pain and the healing as that pain. I just think it's an important topic because often, you know, when I have guests on or, you know, when people are talking about their entheogenic experiences, a lot of times there's a lot of love, there's a lot of bliss, there's a lot of ecstasy, and people, oh, I was transformed and it was such a beautiful experience. And sometimes what we leave out is that sometimes the healing process is fucking grueling and painful and hard. And it's the kind of thing that sometimes people, you know, they want to turn away from. It's like, oh, that was too hard. But you kept going. So I'm curious if you could just, if you're comfortable, just sharing more about that process for yourself and kind of what you're going through and encountering this suffering, but also feeling relief coming through this suffering.
Well, you know, I had gotten to a point where I was so just conditioned by the world not to express it, because as you know, when you have a condition, you know, if you talk about it at all, the first thing people will do is tell you, oh, well, have you tried this supplement? Yeah. Have you tried this? Yeah. Have you tried this? Oh, will you look good?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You don't look like there's anything wrong with you, you know, well, are you sure? And, you know, and when you're already dealing with something that is so soul crushing, it's like you don't even want to put yourself through that. So you're like, okay, well, I will just not tell anyone. Yeah. Or, you know, I ended up becoming a total hermit because it was just so, I mean, there was a few different points where, like I was bed bound before I was pregnant with my daughter. I could only really get up to use the bathroom. And by the time I came to the plant medicine, I could barely walk. Like my left leg, I could barely put any weight on it. I couldn't take my little girl to the park, because if she got away from me, I couldn't run after her to get her.
Yeah.
And so the pain, when I went to SoulQuest initially, I didn't even tell anyone that I had the condition either. Like when we do the intros and everyone opens up about who they are and why they're there, I'm just like, oh, you know, I'm just here for healing and, you know, to experience this, right? And I think my third weekend sessions that I was there, I ended up, there was a guy there and he had fibromyalgia, and I was outside by the fire, and I saw this guy just running around and he was just yelling and there was someone following him. And normally if somebody was behaving like that, they would like, you know, they would intervene. And so I looked up and I'm like, what, you know, what's going on with that guy? And they're like, oh my God, he has the most horrific illness. And he took this medicine and he cannot sit still. He says like, he's on fire. He feels like he's burning alive. He's feeling like he's getting eaten from the inside. He feels like he's being tortured while he's standing there. And I look right at him in the face and I'm like, that's exactly how I feel right now. What does he have?
Yeah.
And they told me, and I was like, and you know, I was on the medicine and I started crying and I was like, I have that condition. And they were like, well, you don't act like it. And like, that's when it just, it dawned on me just how much I hold. And, you know, they actually had me speak to the guy after the ceremony and kind of coach him to sit with it and just be present with it. You know, but it was kind of, around, well, before that, people had said things to me. But after that point is when people really kind of looked at me and they're like, you're definitely called to do some things with medicine. And I was like, no, I'm not, you know, like, but I mean, just, yeah, excruciating. I mean, feels like, yeah, you just consume poison and you're being burned alive, being eaten alive from the inside, being tortured while you're there, being cut open.
Wow.
I knew that I just would just keep sitting with it and telling myself, this energy is inside of you and this medicine is cleaning it out. It's cleaning it out. And so I was doing regular larger psilocybin journeys at home in between as well. And I remember the last one I did, because the mushroom, you know, they tell you when you've had enough big journeys for a while, you know, they told you when they tell you they're, you know, so does they all do. They're like, okay, you know, you've reached this next level and now you can have some time off. And I remember I sat there for over an hour just looking at the mushrooms before I ate them. And I would always do everything so ceremonially, you know, I would get everything, you know, as clean as I could. And there was a while I was doing my henna and, you know, candles and just really doing everything that I could to really make this a pleasant experience and really sacred and ceremonial, especially because it was so challenging. And I was sitting there staring at the mushrooms, just crying. And I just prayed and I was like, please, can I have just one journey that's not excruciating, you know? And as soon as I ate them and tears were coming down my face, I was ugly crying. And then as soon as they kicked in, they were like, we have a surprise for you. And it was such an incredibly blissful journey. And they told me that I had reached the next level and that my journeys would not be as painful anymore because there was so much of this really painful energy that needed to be cleaned out, but I had cleaned it out. And so I was very grateful for that moment. And that was right when we went into the age of Aquarius. I think it was the December 21st, 2020 ceremony that I did. Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. And there's some really interesting sort of lessons in there around. It's interesting that there was this sort of this mirroring that happened when you were at SoulQuest, where there's the guy running around with fibromyalgia, and then you're sitting there and you're holding it all in, and it's kind of like, well, where's the balance between these two? That mm-hmm. one is being reactive and the other is maybe being a bit too held in. Mm-hmm. And also that you hadn't even shared with anyone that you had that. And I totally get that, because I get the same thing. Almost word for word, when I tell people, yeah, I've got this chronic sleep disorder, and it's, oh, well, have you tried this? Have you tried this? And exactly what you say, people always say, well, you look good. It's like, yeah, but it's not about looks. It's not about how we look on the outside. It's about what we feel.
It's like, it's supposed to take everything from me, that too?
Yeah.
That I should
yeah.
look crazy and haggard and sick too, to make you feel comfortable about my illness? Like,
yeah. Yeah. And so for everybody listening, here's just a word of advice for anybody who shares with you that they have a chronic condition. If you have something that you want to share with them that you think is a good remedy or approach, ask them first.
Yes.
If they would like you to share the advice, and
yes.
let them let you know. Because, you know, for those of us who deal with chronic conditions, we've fucking tried everything. We guarantee you. We've tried it all. We've explored it all. And, you know, it's not like there's something brand new under the sun that we haven't thought about, you know. But of course, people are well-meaning along those lines, but it's just important to understand that when people are suffering on a daily basis that, yeah, they've taken every approach that they can find. And so it just becomes a, yeah, I've tried that. Oh, boy, have you tried that? And it just kind of goes around in circles.
Right. And then they look at you and they're like, oh, well, I mean, you're so pessimistic. No wonder you're creating this. And you're like, so you just, you know, I learned to close myself off about it, but, I mean, the quality of life that I am living now, Martin, I mean, I never imagined in my life that I would ever feel like this in my body. I can't remember the last time I felt this way in my body, if ever. But my body is, you know, a safer and safer place to be inside every day. And I'm, you know, I'm able to go out. I used to, a week before it would rain or there would be a storm, even though I used to love storms and being outside in the rain, you know, I would end up with a flare in bed crying because the barometric pressure changes and it affects you, you know. And last summer, you know, after years of this, it started storming. I said, I'm going to go outside in it. And I was outside and it dawned on me when the rain was falling down on my head and I started ugly crying outside. I was like, oh my God, this is the first time in over a decade that not only do I not have a flare up, but I'm out here enjoying this beautiful rainstorm. So a lot of the really small and beautiful parts of life that we really take for granted are things that these chronic conditions rob from you. And I've managed to get so much of that back. And I mean, I went down and I was initiated with the Siri. I went down there twice and trained. And I mean, I did vision quests and fasted, didn't eat or drink in the desert and climbed a mountain. And, you know, like I'm living a really wonderful life that I would consider to be thriving. And I attribute all of this to these beautiful, beautiful sacraments from Earth and all the people that have been there to help me and guide me on my way.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Another thing that I just wanted to comment on from what you shared, because this is something that actually comes up a lot in the integration calls that I do with clients, where someone might be going through a very difficult passage in their work with the medicines. And sometimes people come to me with the question like, so this is really uncomfortable. Does it mean I should stop? You know? And I just love what you shared about this story, that how sometimes what I tell people is, well, you can ask the medicine, like really you're asking yourself, but you can ask the medicine, if this time, can we go easy on me? Can we shift it? And that often these really difficult passages, that they're just that, they are a passage and that you have to go through it, but there is a point where you are then out and then it shifts. And it can be really hard to see when you're in the thick of the pain, when you're in the thick of the suffering, and it feels like, oh, this is never going to fucking end. And if you stop there, then it probably won't ever end. But if you have the courage and the tenacity to go through, very likely it is going to shift at some point. And sometimes it's as simple just as changing your own inner narrative about, I need to suffer. But other times it's not that. And that's another thing that kind of that you mentioned, where like when people would comment to you like, oh, well, you're being very pessimistic. It sounds like you really want this for yourself. That's something that comes up a lot in spiritual circles, is kind of this backhanded approach of, oh, well, there's just a lesson there that you need to learn, or you just need to change your thinking about it. And that ultimately ends up blaming the person for their own suffering. And, you know, some things are beyond our control, and it's important to accept that.
Or I'm not sure if you're a believer in other incarnations or lifetimes, but I mean, as from a soul standpoint, I mean, we've probably been here for a while. And so some of the roots of these things, we don't know everything, and we don't know how far back things might extend, or how deep some of these layers might be in our being.
Yeah. Or even just from the genetic perspective, that, you know, we inherit various things from our parents, and they got things from their parents, and then things manifest differently over different generations. And, you know, that we all get a certain package that we come into the world with. And that's part of what makes us unique and gives us all a unique, different experience of being the human beings that we are. But, you know, I didn't get to choose that my hair was going to thin, you know, that just came with the genes, you know.
Right.
So there's.
So you created that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, and you know that certainly there are children who come into the world with deformities or illnesses, and you know it's just part of the package of being an embodied being. And sometimes the best we can do is live with it, and then appreciate the little things as best we can. So I'd love to get into hearing about some of your training around Bufo, but maybe if we could just start going back to your first Bufo experience. I'm wondering if there's anything there that you felt was significantly different from your work with ayahuasca and the mushrooms. Did it present something new for you, especially in your own healing journey? I'm just curious what you might have to say about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as soon as I first heard about it, I just, you know, I got chills, and they just said, yeah, there's this toad ceremony you should come to, the toad medicine. And I just was like, yep, I don't know what that is, and I'm not going to look it up, but I know I need to go. And they were like, it's really, really strong. It's really powerful. And I was like, I just had this, I was like, I feel like there is a frequency that's going to come through this that I need to anchor in my being. And that's going to help heal this high frequency. And so I ended up going to this ceremony, and it was just, I mean, I don't know if you ever have these surreal experiences of deja vu and synchronicity that really start compounding right before a ceremony. But I mean, it was as intense as, like, during my combo process. I did combo first. I heard the facilitator in my head, and he said, you're going first. And I'm over the bucket, and I'm thinking in my head, oh no, I'm not. and so, but I heard it so clearly. It was the most bizarre thing that I had. Yeah, I hadn't had an experience quite like that. And so afterwards, you know, before we were going to do the medicine, you know, it was outside ceremony style with all the rugs out in a big circle on the property. I'm like, well, you know, there are so many people, because I mean, there were a ton of people there. I'm like, there are so many people here. I'm just going to hang out in the bathroom for a little bit. And like, once I know they're getting started, I'll come out in the bathroom. Cause even though I know that wasn't real, I'm not going first.
Yeah.
And so I'm in the bathroom, and I'm like in the, for like 15 minutes, and like, it's quiet, it gets quiet. And so I'm like, okay, they're definitely started by now. Cause there's a lot of people that needed to be served. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go out now. So I'm going, and I was going to sneak to one of the little blankets on the side in the back, and everyone is sitting quietly. No one is talking. And there the guy is in the center of the circle with his arms crossed in front of his chest. And he points to one open carpet right on the end. And I'm like, you have got to be kidding. I sit down, and he puts the prayer in front of my face and hands me the pipe. And he said, you were going first. And I was like, I had this moment, and I was like, this is real. That was real. And I, like, the totality of what was about to happen started hitting me. And, you know, and I was just like, wow. And I start reading this prayer, and I, you know, I was two lines in, and I start bawling my eyes out, you know, like, as I'm saying the words, you know, and then I'm inhaling and raising up my arms. And then I just went back, and, you know, I saw everything, and it was, I mean, I was taken into this realm of divinity where there was this, I can only describe it as a psychedelic throne that went into infinity, and there were these giant gates, and then there were all these light beings that were really bright, and they looked almost like ghosts, like they had sheets, but they were so bright white. And they came over to me, and they started reaching inside of my energetic body and pulling this stuff out of me. And they said, we are going to take away everything that ever hurt you, and we're going to wipe away all the tears from your eyes. And then I woke up on the mat, and I was crying my eyes out because I literally thought that I died and went to heaven, and I was in heaven, and they were all greeting me there. And there was a lovely woman next to me, and I pulled her down on top of me, and I just held her and cried for a good 10 minutes or so. It was, you know, one of the most, well, yeah, it was, nothing was ever the same again.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a really beautiful and powerful experience for you. And I love the bit about trying to avoid going first and then getting chosen. And it's funny how these things work sometimes, that I certainly have had experiences, like back when I was facilitating, that sometimes kind of similarly, that I would have like a story like play out on my head, like, oh, this person's going to come over, they're going to say this, and this is what I'm going to say, and then they're going to say this, and then I'm going to say that. And then by God, that's exactly what happens. It's like word for word. And, you know, and then sometimes I've even had people tell me the same thing, you know, kind of like you on the other end, on the receiving end. It's like, well, I knew you were going to say that. And my response is always, well, look, always remember there's only one being here. So yeah, weird shit's going to happen like that.
Right. Okay? And it's like, as we get closer to the experience and being in that space, it just picks up.
Yeah, it all sort of collapses, that the boundaries dissolve, and so these weird crossovers, there's like, that can't be real, but no, it is real. And it's fascinating. So then after that, it sounds like you decided to explore Bufo more and actually undergo some training. So yeah, let's go ahead and let's talk about that now, if you feel ready.
Sure.
Yeah.
I met my mentor there, wonderful, wonderful man who would prefer to remain anonymous. Mm-hmm. I agreed to help out because I knew that I knew how powerful it was. I knew I wanted to help and be of service. I knew how important it was to people, especially in an area like I was in. I lived in the Detroit area. That's where I grew up. And, you know, there was nothing up there. And so I said, I don't know who we're going to invite. And I don't know where, I have no idea how this is going to work, but I'll try, you know. And within a week of, you know, arranging, you know, solidifying that, you know, there was 40 people signed up.
Yeah.
And and I was like, okay, like this is really happening. And the way that I was taught is I would probably consider it to be more of in the realm of a shamanic teaching. Like with ayahuasca, they will take the ayahuasca arrows will take the ayahuasca with the participants. Mm-hmm. And I was trained to take a little bit of the medicine with the participants as well.
Yeah.
And so the first time I did this, it was, person after person all day for several days. And, that was a complete transformation in itself, just being in that space and being in that energy and all those processes and having so much of the medicine and at that duration. I mean, everyone... there's lots of people that say they want to get involved, and then it's like, okay. And then you find yourself in the bathroom, locked in there, crying and looking at yourself in the mirror saying, how in the hell did you get yourself into this? What are you doing? You know? But then you go back downstairs and do it again, and you just keep going. And everybody who was there loves it and feels way better and is happy and you feel a lot better, and you're like, this is the truth, you know, and you just keep going. And we went to several major cities, and I couldn't travel as much as I wanted because I do have a little girl, but several major cities, and I couldn't even count how many people at this point, honestly. After a time with that is when I got the invite to go down to Mexico, and I was initiated by Luis Lopez, who is a Siri shaman down there. And I spent 2 weeks with him, and his nephews who were assisting him with what he needed, but on the island of Tiburon. There was no showers, no regular anything. And that was like the most incredible experience ever. And, you know, it's taught me so much. And it was such, you know, a profoundly spiritual experience, because they teach you about what they believe and about, you know, this path. And, you know, then these things that they tell you are going to happen begin happening while you're alone on this island, and you experience this inexplicable spiritual phenomena that is just completely mind-blowing. And I mean, I can't even put into words how incredible it was and how grateful I am. And, you know, I ended up going back down again. And, you know, I went up to a cave that time, and I was alone in a cave for a couple of days. And, you know, the most incredible thing about it was, you know, I was a very devout Muslim for several years, and I fasted Ramadan. I fasted the white days, according to the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I fasted on Mondays and Thursdays. I wore a scarf and an abaya. I went to Jum'ah on Friday, Quran, every, you know, I was very devout. And, during Ramadan, you know, we would fast the whole month from El Fajr to Maghrib, which is the sunset prayer. And, you know, no eating or drinking or, you know, cussing or sex or, you know, any of that. But, you know, you would get really hungry and thirsty during the day, but you would, yeah, you know, yeah, you would just keep going. And the most incredible thing to me about the Vision Quest fasting experiences, especially being out in the desert, I did not get a single hunger pang in my stomach. Like, you know, when your stomach growls because you're just like, I'm so hungry. I did not get that one time. I did not feel like I was going to pass out. And it, I mean, it was just, the spiritual phenomena was something that I could never explain to anyone in a way that would, I feel like it's like, it was like a big journey where it's like you can't really put it into words. It's almost ineffable in experience. So I'm very deeply grateful to have received so much time with so many valuable and extremely wise, knowledgeable, and gifted, beautiful medicine people, and then to have been guided and advised by so many of the same on the path. I feel so deeply blessed to have had that experience, because I feel within the depths of my being that I do this in a very beautiful way, and I am able to, without any bat of an eyelash, keep people very safe and to take them through a beautiful process and a beautiful transformation and just, you know, be there for them. I also I'm a certified integration coach through Being True to You. So I'm available for people after as well if they're struggling.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, one thing that I do wish I would have had on this path that I have not had, I have not been served medicine by a woman. Mm. And I have not had in my space or in my presence that strong feminine presence, or, you know, really any feminine mentorship. So I just kind of took it upon myself to become that, because it's really, really, really needed. And I look forward to the day when I will be served by a woman.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting that you mentioned that, because that's kind of one of the things that I've sort of noticed within the 5-MeO space, is that there are more women who are kind of stepping into the role of facilitating and serving. And that was one of my interests in having you on the show to talk about that. And so I think at some point you probably will find the right woman for that to serve you. And of course, it's so different to be on the receiving end, but I kind of want to go back to one of these issues that you talked about earlier of taking some medicine with the people that you are serving. And this is something that I've been very open about, and I've shared, this is why I've done it, and this is the benefit to it, and this is also what can happen when you take the medicine with the client, that it becomes a very different kind of energetic process. And it's fundamentally different than is, in my opinion, it's fundamentally different than simply being served the medicine, mm-hmm. where someone else is just standing back and kind of, I call that a provider. A provider is someone who provides you with the medicine, provides you with the experience, but they're not taking it and they're not energetically involved in what's taking place. So I'm just curious from your own perspective, how you would describe that action of taking the medicine with the people that you are serving and how you might perceive that as different from, say, taking it for yourself. Because that's also a big distinction that I've made. And I'm just curious your view on it. And, you know, often people ask me, well, how many times have you taken 5-MeO-DMT? And I tell them, well, for myself, I've only taken it about a dozen times, strictly for myself. But when it comes to working with other people, well, then I can't even count the number of times. But I always say, and that's fundamentally different than taking it for yourself. So I'm curious what your perspective is on that as someone who facilitates this way.
Well, I feel like, I mean, everyone has their own opinion on what they would or wouldn't want to do, but I could not imagine serving anyone and not taking it with them. I mean, I'm not sure what happens when you have, you know, taken medicine with people, but you know, as soon as I start inhaling, the process definitely really intensifies. You know, because your field is connected with them and, mm-hmm. you know, this isn't your first rodeo.
Yeah.
But, it's just really beautiful releases. In my opinion, I see people go much, much deeper. I feel like I assist people in releasing things sometimes, or I might kind of take them into my field. I practice Tonglen, which is the Buddhist practice of utilizing the violet flame in compassion. So you'll actually, people do this without medicine all the time, but they'll envision, someone's pain and suffering coming inside of them and then it transmuting. Some will use the violet flame, but others will just kind of maybe use a mantra or a chant or, you know, a frequency or a sound, and then they'll send them back compassion and love. And I do that a lot, just to help unblock the dam and move the energy out, you know, get it out of there.
Yeah. Well, I think it's such an important topic because as we move further into the realm of legal psychedelic therapy, it's mostly being done under what people call like the MAPS model, where basically you have two people sitting around watching someone, potentially holding their hand as they're having their psychedelic experience. And it's considered very taboo within that model that the facilitator is taking the medicine with the client. But as you pointed out, that is actually the standard model in shamanic cultures, that the person running the show is taking the medicine with the client, and that there are reasons for that. And I think within our culture, we're becoming a bit almost prudish around this idea of someone taking the medicine with someone that they're working with, and that it's actually efficacious within that space, and that it helps move and transform energy in ways that don't necessarily happen if someone's just taking it on their own, that it's more of an interactive energetic experience and can allow for certain levels of processing that otherwise might not really be taking place.
Yes, I agree with that wholeheartedly. And with all that being said, to be able to consume this type of sacrament or medicine in a space and take care of someone and function and be completely aware of all of the realms of reality, to be in a complete state of samadhi breakthrough but still be very present and able to care for someone takes years, years of working with someone who really knows what they're doing. There is no week or month long, in my opinion, certification or training that is going to prepare anybody to do this. I mean, like with a lot of our medicines, you know, ayahuasca, there are people that have gone in the jungle and they live down there for 10 years and, you know, train and do lots of ceremonies. And I think that, you know, it's just something that we should really continue to emphasize as facilitators that have a track record of good processes and of you know, good results. You know, if people want to continue to have good results and all these people are wanting to learn and step into it, should be open to that advice. You know, like people are, oh, I think I'm ready to serve the medicine. Okay, well, how long have you been doing this? Oh, I've held space in 40 ceremonies. And I'm just like, no, that's, you know, so many things could happen. And, you know, it just, it takes some time for everyone listening.
Yeah.
Don't do it unsupervised.
Yeah. That, you know, back when I first started facilitating, I didn't necessarily have a mentor. I mean, there just weren't people around to do that. So I kind of had to discover it all myself. But I do write in my book, Entheogenic Liberation, that I do talk about this process of taking the medicine.
Wait, you did it all yourself?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I didn't have anybody to show me, you know, that this was just what developed on my own. But I do say in my book, Entheogenic Liberation, that anybody who wants to work this way, it's like, you need to go through all the work that is described here in order to reach the place where then you can fulfill this role. So it's not just, the idea of casually, well, everybody should be taking medicine with their clients. It's like, no, you need to go through your own shit. You need to work through that. And as you say, be able to be present with a person while in the medicine is so fundamentally different, again, than just taking it for yourself. Because then you can go out as far as you want to go. You can have as much of an inner experience as you want. But when you're serving somebody else, it's about them and being present and then managing that space, but being present within the energy. And it's a high demand process. That's not something that anybody should take casually or just say, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. You know, you gotta learn. You got to learn. So on the other hand, from having the psychedelic therapy model, we do have more the ceremonial church model, in the sense that many people are now kind of claiming their entheogenic rights and developing churches to help serve medicine and facilitate medicine experiences. In ways that don't necessarily adhere to the psychotherapeutic model, which I think is valuable, but also fundamentally limited in a number of ways. And so this is the next topic of conversation that I wanted to move us on to, is the One World Heart Church that you have developed. So yeah, let's get the story on that. When did that inspiration come? What was the process like, and how does it work?
Well, it began coming just, it had kind of been bubbling for quite a while, but when it finally dawned on me was, really started getting imagery and visuals and things for it was actually when I was in the cave the second time that I was in Mexico during that vision quest. You know, and I saw, I read the Mayan calendars. I won't go down that road today, but I saw a lot of different imagery and, all of these gears, and, the church is founded on what's called divine time or frequency 1320, which is a natural frequency that occurs throughout nature and the cosmos. It allows all animals to have an innate sense of when there's going to be something like an earthquake or something happening. And so they all kind of start to move because they're all hooked up to this frequency, which humans have been taken away from. And this is a calendar that people can follow every day. But along with this comes it's almost like psychedelics in a readable, tangible macro organizing principle, because the whole premise is peace through culture and time is art, which it's a 13 moons galactic dream spell calendar. But what it does is it takes everyone's cultural, you know, everything that is culturally significant, everyone's beliefs, and it synchronizes them together and kind of almost demonstrates like the unity point that we find in psychedelics of we're all one, we're all the same. And as we break off into these different cultures and parts of the world and belief systems, it's just emanations of the singular truth and the oneness that we all are, you know, but we all are walking each other home and we're all, you know, at different parts in our journey. And, you know, no one should be forced to accept any kind of truth or any kind of belief that they are not resonating with, or, you know, they just don't feel in alignment with, or they really treasure, you know, whatever it is that they have, and they're satisfied and content with that. This, it's something that melds them all together, just like psychedelics, and holds everyone's beliefs and cultures in this, what I like to call the umbrella of Christ consciousness, of grace. And, so I wanted to, I guess, make it based on that, with the heart centered around our indigenous practices and our ancestors and, you know, the people that all of these sacraments were kind of originally handed to, and giving them a voice. Because, you know, even though some of these medicines or sacraments have been, you know, dormant or not widely used for thousands of years, the truth is there was a period of time where, you know, humanity was using them. And so, you know, the way that we practice and, you know, we like to make sure that we're constantly learning and updating and integrating, not new, but ancient and very timelessly held beliefs and ways of serving and receiving, to continue to honor the greater unfolding of all of humanity and, where we've come, where we've been, where we're at, and, making sure that, you know, no one feels left out. No one feels, like they don't belong, or like, you know, 'cause there's this kind of thinking right now that I almost call it like the giant ego that is the non-ego, or like, you know, there are these people that literally believe that every, you know, it's like spiritual iconoclasm, which depending on where someone is at their process, I mean, not everybody needs to believe the same thing. It's not necessary. What matters is we all need to come together in a cohesive and loving way and accept one another for who we are, because we're all already perfect. We're all already whole. Nobody needs to be fixed. Nobody needs to be changed. Like, the only thing that we can really do is encourage and invite people to the way. You know, if we feel like we might have found a better way than someone else, we can invite them through it with our good actions and our good works. And yeah, that is something that I learned from Islam through Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. We invite with our good works. We invite with our cheerful attitude. We invite with, oh, you know, look at this, you know, I've saved all this money because look at this beautiful garden that I grew in my yard. You know, or, you know, whatever it is that we have that we feel is the better way of being, you know, to just demonstrate and show that. And so, One World Heart is just really centered around honoring everyone and their experience, and, just finding what we believe to be the highest ways of being, and just, you know, just present them all together like a giant tapestry of divine love. you know, and that's, and we do that through alchemy. And, I believe that Bufo especially is, almost, like an initiation into the alchemist's furnace. You know, you walk in and it burns away the wheat from the chaff, you know, and you find out what's real and who you are and who you aren't. And, you know, this really beautiful unfolding happens from that essence that we really connect with and ignite within the heart. Because, you know, if you think about it, the human heart, I mean, if somebody gets in a car accident and they are completely brain dead, so they're a vegetable, but their heart is still beating, they are still alive, okay? But if someone gets in a car accident and they're perfectly fine otherwise, but their heart stops beating, they cease to exist. So the human heart is vitally important. It's got its own neural net system. It's got its own beliefs. There are studies and different accounts of people getting heart transplants where they'll get the heart of someone else and they'll start having memories and things or inclinations towards certain things that the person liked who had that heart. Yeah. Because it's its own little brain there. And so these sacraments, you know, and I learned some things in the cave, the last vision quest I was on, regarding, you know, the inner workings of the heart and how we can see inside the heart with the sacrament. But just to clear out, you know, those painful things, because we don't need to get rid of something unless it's hurting us, you know, or it's like, you know, it's not serving us, or because like we want a change. Like, okay, I don't like that I'm like this at this time and at this moment. Okay, well then we can explore, you know, some other why we're doing this, why we're at this point, and see if we can replace that with something that's better, you know. But we don't need to come in with a wrecking ball and just say, okay, well, all of this that you hold sacred, you know, no, that's a lie. Like, you know, it's not necessary. We can all peacefully coexist and co-create. And I think acceptance, like radical acceptance, compassion, and empathy are, you know, the most important within all of that, because that's how we just come to really accept ourselves. And then when we really accept ourselves, you know, we really accept everyone else and what they've got going on and become just these emissaries of help, you know, and love and assistance, as opposed to separation, division, condemnation, you know, where there's all this mudslinging that happens over all this stuff. And, you know, like with everything going on, the AI and all this, everything that's happening right now, you know, people have an opinion on all of it. You know, every single thing happening, every single person has an opinion. And that's good. We all should have opinions, but being able to stay centered in that with compassion and empathy and just be like, well, there's all of this, you know, and just so that's what we aim to do, is just to unify all of the hearts. We all have the same heart, and to be a human and to be alive on the planet, you know, you need a heart that's beating and working. The earth has a heart, the world has a heart. And so that's why we called it One World Heart, but it honors everyone. It's perennial. So perennial philosophy.
So it sounds like it's a real invitation for people to come and encounter themselves, encounter their own hearts and experience themselves, which is, you know, what a lot of the entheogenic churches are doing. Whereas many prior churches, especially in the United States, they've focused on the idea of belief. And do you believe the right thing? And my church believes the right thing. Your church believes the wrong thing. And then we just fight each other over it. And then another group branches off and say, no, we've developed the right belief. And now they develop their church. And that's how religion has gone in the United States. And that's how we've tended to define religion, is around these beliefs. Versus what you seem to be describing here is more an encounter with your own heart, an encounter with your humanness, and also that connection to the divine that is discovered through the heart and with the assistance of these medicines, and providing a space for people to encounter that and then appreciate the humanness of others as well. And I think that kind of what you were talking about with everybody has an opinion is, I think that that's really been lost a lot, that we tend to view people who don't share our opinions as others, and then we dehumanize them, and then we devalue them, and while at the same time trying to bolster ourselves, but because I'm not that, you know, and there's just foments division, and it foments disharmony, really. And So it's nice to have another way. Let's go into the heart and let's find peace in there, and then maybe be a model for others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I like that, of show by your good works and invite others by your good works. Not, you believe the wrong thing, I'm going to fix you, but I'm doing my best to be a good human being. And hopefully that can inspire others as well. Yeah.
Yes, and you know, and then when we all come together, we all see how similar and how alike we really are, you know, and like even with different psychedelic experiences, depending on where someone is on the planet or what they've been exposed to, you know, they might see emanations of, you know, like they might see Lord Shiva, where someone else might see something like Thoth from Egypt, and just people see different things and they see these different emanations. And when we really look at the philosophies, the core philosophies behind what these different archetypes and what these different symbols and embodiments represent, we see how similar we are, you know, as a collective, as opposed to, you know, oh, I'm right, and oh, you're not right. It's like, oh no, like we're both right.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you just kind of a question at the practical level, and I'll preface it with, I've been talking to a lot of people recently about developing entheogenic churches and how people are doing that and what that involves, and already seeing just a lot of diversity in the sense that for some, it's just, I am the church. I serve individual people here in my home. That is the church. That's kind of the extent of it, and kind of developed the hope of these legal protections of filling out the paperwork as being a church and claiming entheogenic religious rights. And then others are actually holding services, and they're doing weekly or even daily events, and kind of more traditional sort of church-like, or even building a community around it. So I'm curious, for you, with the One World Heart, kind of where does it fall within that spectrum? And also, I'll just kind of throw this out there that I'm considering that this might actually be my next book. That, you know, I recently did the Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT book, which is an anthology of different people who serve 5-MeO and how they work. And I was thinking that this would be the next really interesting topic, is having people talk about their church and what it is and how it functions and what motivates it and how it all works. So that's kind of where I'm coming from and asking you these questions, that I'm thinking about all these things. So,
oh, well, that's great. I will be excited to check that one out, and all of your works are incredible. So thank you for your contributions to the field. I mean, wow. but yeah, as far as like, it's, so it was in the makings for a while, and it's relatively new. We do offer regular integration services. Mm-hmm. We offer a variety of ceremonies. We have started to do some kind of local gatherings and events. You know, but really, however big it is meant to get, or whatever is meant to come from it, I feel will. Right now, I'm very focused locally on, you know, I'm currently in one of the most segregated communities in the United States. And so, I mean, I'm here for a reason. And so local bridges are being built around here, and it's kind of expanding. But I really, you know, I really would like to have something grow pretty substantially locally, and, you know, just continue from there.
So you mentioned Detroit earlier. Is that where you still are, or where is your local community?
Oh no, I actually that's been the other part of it. So I grew up in Detroit, and I lived in the Detroit area, and I moved 400 miles away. I am in Milwaukee, Wisconsin now.
Wow.
And so I'm here now, and it was, yeah, and then I didn't know for a while if I was going to be staying here or not. And so we are staying here. We're staying here for the foreseeable future anyway. You know, and so now we're getting our hard hats and our hammers out, and we're getting everybody together.
Wow. Well, that's great. I mean, this has also been kind of a newer development in the psychedelic world, is that I think, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast, they've been pretty progressive, and there's been a lot of interest in psychedelics for, you know, past couple generations in these areas. But some places in the Midwest or in the South, it, you know, it hasn't really been cultivated there. But now this is what's happening, is these entheogenic churches are popping up and opening their doors, either metaphorically or literally, and bringing new people in. And there's such a new interest in these medicines from both the healing perspective and also from the spiritual perspective. And mm-hmm. it's like American culture has just gotten disaffected with the belief thing. Like, okay, you know, like most young, you're younger than I am. Most young people, they're not identifying as one religion or another anymore. Cause they're kind of sick of the divisiveness of it and the focus mm-hmm. on what you believe. But this desire for direct experience is still very, very strong, and it's growing. And that's where I see these, because, you know, probably a lot of these places, like in the South and the Midwest, they're probably not going to be having legal psychedelic therapy anytime soon. Mm-hmm. You know, versus like here in Oregon, California, you know, these places where the legal psychedelic therapy movement is pretty strong. So the avenue in for a lot of people might be these kinds of churches, and that are offering an experience in a supportive environment that also is, as you say, providing integration. I think it's really important. And even back when I was first starting out in this field, I mean, integration wasn't even a term that was used. And sometimes people ask me, like, what did you do to integrate your 5-MeO experiences when you were going through your awakening transformations? Like nothing. I just kind of kept going because it wasn't even a thing. Like, nobody even talked about it, this idea of quote unquote integration. So it's nice to see that you're incorporating that into your church. So at this point, how many people are involved in it, would you say?
Oh, gee, well, it depends on where we're at and what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Locally, we have got a handful that are involved with kind of helping out. But when these things kind of first get started, you know, sometimes people will want to be involved, and then they'll kind of, you know, they might like want to be more present at the ceremonies, and then they might want to help in a different way. So sometimes it can kind of like it takes a minute to kind of land, mm-hmm. you know. But we've got some pretty awesome individuals over here. But it's me, my serving partner Tyler, who is also he stays here, and. We are the facilitators, and then we've got, you know, different people who we have hold space and help out with ceremony and things like that. But there are, and that's why I'm not sure where things will go, but I have had a couple of really wonderful women in the United States that are just wonderful, and they have reached out and asked me if I'm offering any mentorship opportunities. Because they would like to learn from me to serve. And so that's, you know, I have no idea what will happen next.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. It's nice to be at a point where things are developing, but yeah, you don't need to know where it's going to go just yet to keep going. And so are you one of these folks that you've done all the paperwork, you've filed your forms and, you know, crossed all the legal T's and dotted all the legal I's and those kinds of things?
Yes. I did do that. You know, because I want to make sure everything is good, but my attorney, he's wonderful, but he told me, he said, literally, you know, as an attorney, most of the time we tell you to just be quiet. And he said, if anything were to happen, I would just put you on the stand and just be like, let her talk. Because, yeah. You know, it's very clear that this is a religion or you really genuinely believe these things, you know, all of your life work, your experience, your culmination, you know, you've studied with the indigenous and everything, you know, so it is legitimate, yeah. You know, it's not, he said, I'm not someone who would be, you know, one of those people who would just kind of be trying to use the legal protections or whatever, but, it's a sincere religious belief, and it is, you know, I could sit here and talk for, you could really get me talking all day.
Yeah. And that in the United States, that is what it comes down to. Is it a sincere belief? That's how we've defined religion. I've spoken elsewhere about why that is a bad definition of religion. It doesn't really fit at the global level, but it's how we define it in the United States. And that there have been potential churches in the past that where the government said, oh, it's just an excuse. You guys just want to get high. But I think that argument is just being washed away by what we now know of, as you've mentioned, of the history of entheogenic use within cultures and the importance within many religions around the world, that we can't just poo-poo and dismiss people anymore, and that people like yourself are coming to it with a lot of sincerity, and that we do consider this to be quote-unquote sacred, however you want to define that. And so that, you know, I think that these new entheogenic churches are totally legitimate, and I'm fascinated by them. And yeah, if I do put together this book project, of course you will be invited to submit a chapter for yourself and for the One World Heart, because this is what's developing now. It's like so brand new in American culture that this is happening, and I'm really excited about it. Because, you know, I have my PhD in religious studies, but we never studied any of this when I was a graduate student. You know, it was never even talked about how entheogens have played roles in all of these traditions, and I've always wanted to help educate people around that. And this new cultural development, I think, is just really, really fascinating, and really curious where it's all going to go. So
yeah, I'm so grateful to hear that. And with all of that being said, my only thing is, like, as long as people that are doing the churches have, you know, they've done the work and they have had the training and the apprenticeships, and they've done their stuff with the sacraments, you know, and they're really prepared to do this, you know, that's the important thing.
Yeah. That you're taking on a responsibility, and you've mm-hmm. got to be willing to take that on and actually live up to it. So Jessica, I've had you on for a while now, and I'm going to have to run shortly because I have got to pick up my son from school and just a little while from now. But I do want us just to spend a little bit of time touching on, and I'm not even going to try and pronounce it, this ceremony that you were recently involved in with Tom Lane and some of these Mesoamerican traditions. I'm just curious, anything you'd want to share about it that you had mentioned? We had been, you know, messaging back and forth, and you said, "Whoa, I just went through this amazing ceremony." I said, "Okay, great. Well, we could talk a little bit about it." But anything you'd want to share about that? And please educate me on how do I pronounce this word?
You know what? It's hilarious because I've only read the word; I haven't heard it pronounced. So
it's TEMICXOCH. Like maybe Temixoc.
Yeah, Temixoc or Temixoc, maybe. Please forgive us, anyone who's listening, if we slaughtered that. But if you will take into consideration that we learned about it from reading, but it was the most incredible, intense experience I have ever had ceremonially. And what I had to do is I had to take the mushrooms and dip them. Well, I had to fast for a day. And then the next day I make cacao. I learned from a Guatemalan Mayan elder how to make cacao. And I made cacao, drank cacao. And then I took the mushrooms and I dipped them into honey and just put them in my mouth, and you just chew them.
Yeah.
And you chew them and you chew them and you chew them and you chew them until they will completely dissolve in your mouth. So it goes from like being this big mass to being, you know, till you're like, there's nothing in my mouth anymore. And, I mean, it hits you. And then, I had to print out, a codex, and I was given instructions on how to read it. And I read the codex, and it brings they call them a time person, who is Quetzalcoatl, Quetzalcoatl, into the space. And I mean, I have never experienced such a profundity. I mean, I started looking at it, and the whole room started shaking, and like everything started just completely re-putting itself together. And like, as I was moving my eyes across to each different picture on the codex, and then they all started interacting with each other. And then the entire room, like I was gone from the room and I was outside of the Temple of the Sun. And there were all of these singing flowers. And it was just the most profound thing. Like, it was the most blissful, colorful, profound thing. And then I was shown, you know, why everything happened down there from Quetzalcoatl about Cortez coming, because there was a whole controversy. The only reason Montezuma let him in was because of it was a case of mistaken identity, mm-hmm. because he arrived on one reed, which was the day that Quetzalcoatl was supposed to come, and the priesthood was told, you guys got to stop the sacrifice or he's not coming. And they wouldn't listen. And so Cortez ended up going there and they let him in because they thought that he was the one they were waiting for. And it was history. But I was taken, you know, below the temples where all the bones were. And there, I mean, I had to hold a pillow on my face for a duration of time because I felt... It felt like my heart just kept getting cut out over and over and over and over and over again. Like I was somehow feeling the energy of the bones of these people that had gone through that. And it was basically hell on all sides. It was really extremely intense. But, you know, then after that, you know, and after I was shown many things and brought out of that, you know, I have a codex of Pakal-Votan, and, you know, Quetzalcoatl told me, he said, well, talk to Pakal because Pakal can prove what I'm telling you. And I said, okay. Mm-hmm. So I picked up the thing of Pakal and it starts shaking and he starts talking to me and he told me what dates I needed to look up when I was done with the ceremony, which I looked up and I was able to calculate within the time signatures, you know, evidence of things that in a lot of ways exonerate Jose and Loidin Arguelles, which were, I mean, their work was assaulted by a lot of people because they were like, well, why are you just taking this calendar and making your own? Because they, you know, they were accused of all these different things. And so it was really just this big, giant ceremony of cosmic, oh my God. And, I didn't want to tell anyone about it personally. You know, however, I was very urged, especially by some people that learned underneath Jose and Loidin Arguelles, who knew them when they were alive. They really urged me to come forward and share that information. Because they really just felt like it would help exonerate their reputations and help to unify, you know, the long count and the indigenous practicers of the timepiece, as well as the galactic dream spell model, and create more harmony within that. And so I shared the information publicly, but it's nothing that I, because I was just like, it was just so big. But I feel like it healed my body in another really, really big way. It changed my heart. It's called the Ceremony of the Defied Heart. And it's just really, I mean, I've always had a passion and an invigoration to hear indigenous voices and what they have to say and their perspectives and their opinions and to learn their ways. But this has just been really heart-opening for me in so many ways in that regard, because especially when we're talking about, you know, we're talking about an experience like that versus an experience where you're in a clinical office and have some mushrooms with someone and might see a few things. Like, yeah. You know, from all the experiences I've had, like, it shows me how deeply important these indigenous practices are and these wisdom keepers that have been holding these medicines for thousands of years and using them. Like, they really know what they're doing here, and this can really help in a very big way. so I am just so deeply grateful for Maria Sabina. She passed away 2 years before I came to Earth, and I am so grateful for her. And I am so grateful to Tom for, you know, he did live with her for a while, and he's really passing the torch, and he's open with all of his information, you know, but it's definitely a ceremony that, takes a bit of courage to do, but it was the most profound thing. And, I'm just really excited. And I, you know, through One World Heart, within a few weeks, we're going to be offering jewelry and artwork from the Siri, from the Comcac women, which is the people that I went and was initiated into. We're going to be selling some of their jewelry and artwork for them, and the proceeds will go to them, just as a way to uplift them and give back and just say thank you. Thank you for your wisdom and your medicine and everything that you so gracefully share with us. And I really hope that it can help inspire other people to be more inspired by the indigenous wisdom that is there and available that they are wanting to share, and to also, you know, financially give when and where they can to help uplift these communities, because they really deserve it.
Well, thank you for sharing all that, Jessica. It sounds like a very, very profound experience. And just for the listeners out there, I would say that, you know, I do have an interview with Tom Lane, and he does talk all about this codex that you were mentioning here. At this point, the interview is so old that it is transferred from the Active podcast that is now available on the Entheogenic Evolution Archive, which is available to my supporters over my Patreon page. So that's where it lives these days. But for anybody who's curious, I did have him on. I think he talked for about 2 hours talking about the whole thing. So we probably just barely scratching the surface of it.
I mean, I can only imagine what each individual experience with that would be like, because I guarantee they would all be completely different and probably just very deeply related to that person and their journey in whatever kind of a way. You know, but I'm excited to take people through that when the time is right.
Cool.
As well. Yes.
Well, Jessica, to wrap it up, maybe we can just finish with, for anybody who's listening, who's like, I'd like to get in touch with Jessica. I'm curious in the One World Heart. How do I get involved? What's the best way for people to find you or reach out to you or make contact, if that's even something that you're open to?
Oh, yeah. We have a website, www.oneworldheart.love. So www.oneworldheart.love. L-O-V-E.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and for your sharing today, Jessica. Really appreciate it. It's been wonderful to get this chance to get to know you and hear a little bit more of your story and your experiences and what you're offering. And it's just been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much, Martin. I am so grateful and honored. And thank you so much for your contribution to all of this work and to the field. And you're constantly moving with all of your wonderful content and your books and your audiobooks and your graphics and your, I mean, you're just really incredible. So thank you as well, Martin. And thank you for having me.
Oh, well, thank you for saying so. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.